Hi, listeners. I'm Haley Bloomquist, audio editor behind the latest season of Making Stories Without End. Thanks for listening to Making. This week, we wanted to share something new from our friends from Prologue Projects. Introducing Final Thoughts, the story of how Jerry Springer became Jerry Springer. This series pulls back the curtain on a complicated legacy, built right here in Chicago, through nearly 60 interviews with the people who knew him best. Final Thoughts is as much about politics as it is about pop culture, about how a man's ideals collided with the spotlight and what he chose to do next. We hope you enjoy the first two episodes here, and if you want to hear more, you can find Final Thoughts exclusively on Audible. Go to audible.com/springer to sign up for a free 30-day trial.
Will you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Jerry Springer.
Will you spell your last name? For the court.
I understand. S-P-R-I-N-G-E-R.
Okay. And the
on June 4th, 1999, the Chicago City Council chambers turned into a stage. It was a full house. Even the balcony seats were taken. And multiple cable networks were broadcasting the proceedings live. At the center of it all was a man in surprisingly good spirits for someone who had been dragged in front of a government tribunal to answer for his sins.
And Mr. Springer, what is your business or occupation?
I host a television show. It's called The Jerry Springer Show.
And are you also a licensed...
As everyone in the room knew, The Jerry Springer Show wasn't just a television show. It was an international phenomenon that, to many, represented nothing less than the decline of Western civilization. It was the first talk show in over a decade to beat Oprah in the ratings. And its reputation as one of the trashiest, ugliest, most depraved shows in the history of TV was uncontested.
Tell us about this bizarre relationship you have.
Well, I'm pregnant by my brother.
On any given day, you could tune in to see a mother-daughter dominatrix duo, a man finding out his girlfriend is a prostitute and that she's sleeping with his brother, or someone confessing to their fiancé that they've been lying about their gender.
What is it that you've been keeping from him?
That I'm a transsexual.
The week of the hearing in Chicago, viewers were introduced to a man who wore diapers on dates.
You wear diapers every day?
Every day gets a chance without getting in trouble.
Most days, the show followed a predictable format, with a big reveal setting things in motion.
I slept with your sister.
Followed by a confrontation that often turned obscene.
Not but a trigger.
Not to mention physical.
It was before hoes, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Conducting this circus day after day was Jerry Springer, who had crafted an image of a mild-mannered, sometimes self-deprecating host whose job was merely to referee the on-screen chaos. He ended each show with a final thought, a brief, friendly commentary offering up the moral of the story.
Yes, you want the person you love to love you back, but they're not loving you back if they don't know the real you. They are simply loving who you're pretending to be. That's pretty empty. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other.
Springer was a ripe target in 1999. Less than a month before he was invited to appear in front of the Chicago City Council, two teenagers had carried out a mass shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado. In the aftermath, as people tried to understand how such a terrible thing could have happened, Springer's name came up. When filing a lawsuit against the parents of the shooters, a lawyer representing a victim's family lamented that our children were being raised by Jerry Springer and the internet. News programs quoted teachers venting about Springer's influence in their classrooms.
So many of my students love Jerry Springer. And what does he encourage? You have a problem with somebody, you throw your fist around, you slam a chair over their head, or you curse them out.
Springer's appearance before the city council was technically part of a hearing of the Police and Fire Committee. Springer, whose show was taped in Chicago, was on the agenda because he had attracted the ire of a former cop turned alderman named Ed Burke.
If it's a crime to slap your wife at Sox Park or Soldier Field, then it's a crime to slap your wife on the stage at the Springer Show.
In a formal resolution, Burke argued that if the fights happening on the set of Springer's show were real, then guests should be getting arrested for assault. And if the fights weren't real, that is, if the Jerry Springer Show was fake, then Springer should admit it and file for an entertainment license to film in Chicago. The day of the council hearing, a diverse crowd of mostly young people gathered outside City Hall and chanted Springer's name. Some of the more vocal Jerry fans on the scene told reporters they were part of a group called PETS, People for the Ethical Treatment of Springer. They carried signs saying, "Support Springer and fight for free speech," while a single counter-protester dressed in a clergy robe shouted, "Jesus is coming and Jerry must go." Earlier that morning, a 55-year-old Jerry Springer had approached City Hall sporting a slick suit and tie and a big grin. There were camera crews from all over the world clamoring for a shot of Springer on his way into the hearing. He looked almost bashful at all the attention, but it was obvious he was eating it up.
Do you feel your reputation's on the line?
My reputation, you know, just don't worry about my reputation, that's gone.
How do you feel about the city council calling you here? Do you think there was a necessity to do this?
I'm honored, you know, they want to invite me, that's great. It's not my life, it's television.
When he finally entered the chambers, he was met with thunderous applause from spectators. And as he made his way to his seat, he shook the hands of each and every alderman, like a politician maneuvering a rope line. It quickly became clear that Alderman Burke didn't have much support from the rest of the city council. Only one of his colleagues had endorsed his resolution, and the chair of the council, William Beavers, seemed to question the point of the hearing.
That's a waste of time. Yes, it is. But because the resolution was introduced and sent to my committee for a hearing, I have to give him a hearing.
So Burke would be Springer's chief antagonist. As he kicked off his line of questioning, the tension began to simmer immediately.
You are a resident of the city of Chicago, I believe?
Yes.
And where is your residence?
I live in the Hancock Building.
Okay. And what's the address, sir?
175. Well, I don't want to tell everyone.
Despite Springer's objections, Burke went ahead and read his home address into the record.
You know where I live.
I believe you did say, Mr. Witness, you live at the Hancock Building.
You can call me Mr. Springer or Jerry. Yes, I live in the Hancock Building.
And the address of the Hancock Building is 175 East Delaware, isn't it?
Yeah, thank you very much.
This interaction set the tone for the sarcastic back and forth that would continue for several more hours.
And are you also a licensed attorney?
I don't practice now, but yes, I graduated law school here at Northwestern University.
Northwestern University, very prestigious Chicago law school. Yeah.
At this point, I suspect they're trying to destroy all my records. But
even though Alderman Burke had called the hearing, he soon found himself on the defensive. When he pushed Springer to reveal how long his contract was for and how much it was worth, Chairman Beavers came to Springer's defense.
Alderman Burke, what does this have to do with the resolution?
Yeah.
Can you show me what you're trying to do?
I think the relevancy, Mr. Chairman, would go to who actually has control over the product and who controls what happens on the soundstage over at NBC Tower.
Well, why don't you ask him that?
When Burke kept pushing, Springer got serious.
We have to be very careful here. You're the government. And this is America. And I don't mind coming here, talking to you about my show. You can ask me questions. Do you think the fights are real or are they fake? You can, that's fair discussion. But be careful. I don't work for you, sir. I really don't. And that isn't, I'm trying to be very respectful, but you're not the boss.
While Burke sputtered, Springer came off as comfortable and confident, self-deprecating about both himself and his show, but also fiery and sharp.
So you don't know who it is that owns the entity that employs you?
I get up in the morning. I go to work. I do my warm-up jokes. I'll give you a couple of them later on. Then we do the show. We have a good time, and we go home. I know where I get my paycheck.
So long as your paycheck comes in, that's all you are concerned with?
My concern in life is to be a good human being, is to be a loyal employee, is to work hard for the paycheck that I get. In this particular job, is to provide an entertaining show, is to please my fans and be a good human being. Those are my concerns. Do I like getting paid? Yeah, I enjoy getting paid. I didn't think that was un-American. I enjoy it.
After an hour and 42 minutes, the hearing finally got to the heart of Burke's complaint. The fighting. Everyone wanted to know, were Springer's guests actually trying to hurt each other? Or were they just putting on a show?
Mr. Springer, is the violence on your show staged or real?
It looks real to me.
Is the violence, and I mean the punching, the kicking, the swearing, the pulling of clothes, the pulling people down and wrestling them to the ground, is that encouraged by your producers?
I certainly hope not, no.
The council members seemed frustrated by Springer's hedging on this point. An alderman named Bert Nateris tried to pin Springer down on what he thought his show was achieving.
What is the purpose, really, of your program? What are you trying to do? Are you trying to change society?
Nope.
Are you trying to be humorous? Are you trying to show people how life really is? Are you trying to give employment to would-be actors? I mean, what is the purpose of your show?
The purpose? I have said this so many times publicly. I think it's a silly, crazy, outrageous show. I think it's chewing gum. I think the world will be fine with it. The world will be fine without it. Just talk to your friends, because every single one of you here has someone you deeply respect in your life that, if under oath, would have to admit that once in a while they've watched the show. Not a person that you think is sick, not a person that you think is going to go to hell, just a regular person. It could be in your...
Then Nateris acknowledged the obvious, that a huge driver of Springer's success was the show's transgressive nature. The more hand-wringing and moralizing there was about it, the better its ratings would likely be.
Don't you think that the city council really has done you a big favor today?
Well, yeah, but...
Yeah, you know what's going to happen? As a result of these hearings, and I think they're being televised all over the world by the number of cameras we have here, I think your ratings are going to go up. You know,
they can't
I think,
go up much
I'll be
higher,
very honest
with
you, I think
there.
That's why you came here. I think that's why you came here today. I don't think you came here out of any respect for this body or the people asking the questions. And I personally think you probably think we're a bunch of sanctimonious buffoons, which we're not.
After nearly 3 hours, the hearing came to an end, and the throngs of press followed Springer out into the hallway to get his reaction.
You know, I make no excuses for the show. I'm not running away from it. It's my show. It's got my name on it. That's why I showed up. I'm not going to say, oh, it's not my business. It's my business. I enjoy doing it. I love doing it. I love doing it.
Do you have any way to change anything about that?
That evening, Springer hosted his first ever pay-per-view event. For $6.99, viewers could watch uncensored clips and outtakes from the show. It was an extension of Springer's lucrative collection of Too Hot for TV VHS tapes.
More than just Big Apples in these bays.
In the end, the Jerry Springer Show wasn't forced to get an entertainment license or to arrest its guests. The council resolution was tabled and taken under advisement. By most accounts, Springer had come out of the hearing on top.
Who won here, city council or Jerry Springer?
Oh, clearly Jerry Springer.
Springer had come off in the hearing not as an airheaded talk show host or a Hollywood lightweight, but as a seasoned politician. And that's because he was. Back in the 70s, long before the Jerry Springer Show debuted, he was a city councilman himself in Cincinnati, Ohio, where he was widely regarded as a rising star in the Democratic Party.
The answers to the problems which currently plague our cities, our towns, and our homes are to be found in the hearts, minds, and resources of our own people here at home.
Springer also knew how to deliver a perfect soundbite for the cameras, having spent nearly a decade as a local news anchor and an Emmy Award-winning TV journalist.
Good evening. The message tonight from the folks who live and work in the east end of Cincinnati was loud and clear. No more benzene, period.
And yet, the job Springer held longer than any other, the job he chose to devote his life to, was hosting the Jerry Springer Show. The show ran for 27 years and banked nearly 4,000 episodes before it finally stopped taping in 2018. Since then, a lot of people have wondered what mark the show left on us, on our culture, and on our politics. Whether or not you find yourself compelled by the righteous alderman of the Chicago City Council, it doesn't seem crazy to think that this globally iconic show had a real impact on how people treat each other and talk to each other, and what sorts of things we're willing to share in public about our private lives. It also doesn't seem crazy to suggest that Springer softened the ground for, well, you know,
Donald Trump's strategy, which is scorched earth. You think the Jerry Springer show is tasteless? I mean, this is the Jerry Springer show of politics.
The year before the Chicago City Council hearing, Springer published an autobiography called Ringmaster. At the beginning of the book, Springer envisions himself at the pearly gates, face to face with God. The premise is that Springer will tell God his life story, and God will decide whether he belongs in heaven or hell. In the end, God lets Springer go back down to earth, proclaiming him an unfinished work and urging him to keep fighting the good fight against elitists who would suppress freedom. When Jerry Springer died in April of 2023, the first line of his New York Times obituary credited him with setting a new standard for tawdriness on American television. It closed with a quote from Springer himself. "If I get to heaven, we're all going." Behind the joke was a life guided by conflicting ambitions and values that even some of Springer's closest friends didn't know how to reconcile. He was a moralist, but also a nihilist. A comedian, but also a foreign policy wonk. The host of the so-called worst TV show of all time. And a would-be leader of men who dreamed of making a positive impact on the world. So what impact did Jerry Springer make on the world? What did his show do to the people who watched it? Not to mention the people who were on it and the people who helped make it.
The Jerry Springer Show is television without its makeup on. It is no different than anything else on TV other than we are not trying to make ourselves pretty.
A lot of people wanted to come on the Jerry Springer Show, and a lot of people wanted to watch it. So what do I have to be ashamed of?
Whether you like it or not, this show stuck with us. It hit a nerve and lodged itself into our collective memory. Even if you never watched it, you remember it and recognize it as a step along the way to wherever we are now. How did that happen? And how did Jerry Springer, of all people, turn out to be the guy who led us down that road?
He is certainly one of the many co-conspirators of the world I think we live in now. I don't blame him for it, but was he a participant in it and a co-conspirator in it? Absolutely. From the Jerry Springer that I heard about that was mayor and other things he was about to the Jerry Springer that I saw on the show, it was like two different people.
Our goal in this series is not to render judgment on whether Jerry Springer deserved to go to hell for his TV show, or even to try to resolve his apparent contradictions. Rather, it's to tell a story about choices, how we make them, how we justify them to ourselves, and how we transcend them, or don't. I'm Leon Nafok. From Audible Originals and Prologue Projects, this is Final Thoughts, Jerry Springer.
I run because it has become increasingly evident that unless some new alternative, some new initiative, some new approach is injected into the political life of our community, we are destined to lose here at home the very prize we seek to defend abroad, the politics of participation.
This is Jerry Springer at the age of 25. At the time of this recording, he had just made the surprising, some might say arrogant, decision to run for Congress in Ohio. Springer had only recently moved to Cincinnati to work at a local law firm. He looked like a classic carpetbagger, and this alone made the congressional run an uphill climb. But it got even worse. Springer was also a liberal, a progressive even, and he had decided to run in a very conservative district where he would be competing against a five-term Republican incumbent.
My campaign is based upon the proposition that the answers to the problems which currently plague our cities, our towns, and our homes are not to be found in the decisions in Washington. They are instead to be found in the hearts, minds, and resources of our own people here at home.
The intonation was exactly Robert F. Kennedy.
It was a slight Queens accent.
With a slight Queens accent, right.
Evelyn Springer Strout wasn't surprised to see that her little brother was in a hurry to run for office. Gerald, as she still calls him, had worked for RFK's presidential campaign before moving to Cincinnati. And long before that, he had absorbed his family's passion for liberal politics at the dinner table.
We always discussed politics at the table. I mean, because we wanted to assimilate. We always discussed how life was in Europe versus it is in America and how grateful we were to be here. The one thing my father always asked was, what did you learn of America today?
For young Evelyn and Gerald, this question, what did you learn of America today, was a matter of survival. Their parents had escaped Nazi Germany in 1939, just weeks before the start of World War II. The family then spent a decade living in London, where both kids were born, before taking the Queen Mary across the Atlantic to New York. They first moved into a hotel in Manhattan, which had been converted into housing for refugees and concentration camp survivors. Eventually, they settled in the working-class community of Kew Gardens, Queens. Evelyn and Gerald's parents rarely talked directly about the Holocaust or the grandparents, uncles, aunts, and cousins who had been killed in the camps. But it was clear that their experience under the ultra-right-wing Nazi regime had shaped their politics.
My parents were very big advocates for Jack Kennedy. I mean, they were always liberal, no question.
Evelyn says her brother had plenty of opinions of his own, political and otherwise.
He would stand on a table in the hallway and start pontificating and start giving speeches. I mean, he was maybe 7 years old, 8 years old. And every time we would pass by, we would have to stop and listen. And if we didn't, we would get it. So, I mean, that was already the beginning of his love of talking, of telling people things. And he was funny.
It was nearly two decades later that Springer decided to seek out a bigger table to stand on by running for Congress in Ohio. The same week he announced his run, he was called up to the Army Reserves as part of the Vietnam War effort.
My name's Jerry Springer, and I'm currently serving in the United States Army Reserve at Fort Knox, Kentucky.
At the time, the voting age in most states was 21, which meant that 18, 19, and 20-year-olds could be drafted but didn't have the right to vote. Springer had gotten involved in an effort to lower the voting age in Ohio after moving to Cincinnati. In the middle of his congressional campaign, he was invited to Washington, D.C. to testify on the issue before the Senate.
I imagine that I could take a few minutes here and discuss the merits of 18-year-olds as a voter.
Sitting in front of a panel of lawmakers, Springer sported a military crew cut and a dark suit. He had several sheets of paper laid out in front of him, but he barely glanced down at them as he spoke. Unlike the politicians he was addressing, Springer had lived with the possibility that his draft number would be pulled and the impossibility of doing anything about it at the ballot box.
18-year-olds pay taxes, 18-year-olds are considered adults before courts of criminal law, and 18-year-olds can fight and die for their country. Yet despite all these responsibilities which our young people have, it is only the 1 or 2% who protest and riot. It is only they who have any political voice because we respond to violence. I think
the time has come to give the president. The 26th Amendment was the fastest amendment to ever work its way through government. It passed in just over 3 months. It also helped Jerry Springer fast-track his political career. After leaving boot camp and returning to his congressional campaign, Springer sailed through the Democratic primary. And even though he ended up losing in the general election a few months later, he put up an impressive challenge to the incumbent Republican, getting 44% of the vote, far more than anyone expected.
We thought it was great. We thought, my gosh, you know, get into the politics of this country would be terrific.
Springer's family watched his forays into Ohio politics from the East Coast. They were supportive and excited. It felt right that their Gerald was making a career out of talking to strangers.
He's an entertainer. I mean, he knows how to entertain and he knows how to carry a crowd. He knows those things.
Where did he learn that?
That was innate. From the table where he started pontificating. That's where he learned it.
Evelyn knew that her brother's congressional run was just the beginning. It was clear to her that he would continue to seek out more tables to stand on.
Every entertainer and everyone in public life, politicians particularly, like, you know, the attention that they get. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. I mean, that's human nature. Some take it too far and then sacrifice what they believe in for the people. And some can, you know, tame it.
Jerry Springer would spend much of his life fighting for and winning the attention of strangers around the world. For now, he would be satisfied with just getting the people of Cincinnati to like him. What would it take for this outsider, this Jewish liberal from Queens, to win over a struggling Rust Belt city?
People in Cincinnati talked about him, his political talents and his charisma, like equivalent of Bill Clinton, they said.
Well, maybe. But he was better than Bill Clinton. He was my brother.
I'm Leon Nafok. From Audible Originals and Prologue Projects, this is Final Thoughts, Jerry Springer. Chapter 2, The Idealist. John Snow was 24 years old and working in construction when he first met Jerry Springer at a bar near the University of Cincinnati.
He kind of looked unkempt a little bit, and God, his hair, it was too long, and it didn't, you know, and it kind of went one way and then the other.
It was 1971. On the heels of his failed congressional bid, Springer was running for a seat on Cincinnati City Council.
The boss of my union said, "Hey, we're supporting this guy for city council. You need to meet him."
Snow found Springer charismatic, and he liked what he had to say. So when Springer's campaign manager offered him a job, Snow took it.
So I went to work for Jerry Springer. I was his body man.
A body man is kind of like a personal aide, part assistant, part driver. Snow, who looks like Santa crossed with a pro wrestler, was also a kind of de facto bodyguard. But his most important job on the campaign was to shepherd Springer from event to event and try to keep him on schedule.
When you're in a conversation and it's time to go to the next event, I'm the guy that says, "We got to go, Jerry." And he, you know, he feigns like, you know, "Oh, God, no, we can stay. No, come on, come on."
Snow's role was especially important because of Springer's relentless campaign schedule. His congressional run had earned him the attention of local Democratic Party officials, but a lot of voters in Cincinnati still hadn't heard of him. So Springer threw himself into the work of introducing himself and showing up at every venue in the city that would have him.
God, it was a schedule that would kill you. I'd pick him up at 6 in the morning. First thing, we'd grab a coffee, we'd get it, you know, get it rolling. We're gone. All day. I mean, 6:30 Western Hills Bowl. All the women are up there bowling, and Jerry's, you know, there. "Hi, I'm Jerry Springer. I'm up at the bar drinking more coffee, and I know this day is not going to end till midnight."
We actually found a stack of Springer's old daily agendas from his city council campaigns. On one Saturday alone, he attended a local civics meeting, a neighborhood festival, two parades, and a college football game. He then went to a wedding and a high school fair and closed out the day with a telethon, a church dinner banquet, a cocktail party, and a visit to a local Democratic club.
And it was, and we'd be done about 11, 12 o'clock at night. And the next morning, it'd start again.
Springer was running for one of 9 spots on the Cincinnati City Council. There were a total of 19 candidates. And because it was an at-large race, Springer was running against all of them. If he could break into the top 9 on election day, he would get a seat. Most of Springer's rivals in the 1971 race were people who had run multiple times before. To have any chance at all at getting enough votes, Springer had to work twice as hard as them. It helped that voters seemed to love him. They didn't even see him as an outsider.
I could hear women talking to each other. Oh, God, Myrtle. He went to school with Jerry at Elder High School. Oh, he went to school with him at Oak. He's from Kew Gardens, New York. I mean, and I didn't correct him. They said, well, you know. Oh, he did? Oh, God. When did he graduate? Oh, the same year as Marvin. You know, they all thought he was from Cincinnati.
That was Jerry. He was my nemesis, I thought, because he was so articulate and so convincing. And you would argue a point and he would counterpoint and you'd say, oh, my God, I wish he'd stop.
Guy Guckenberger was another young candidate in the city council race. Though he was a Republican, the fact that he and Springer were both in their 20s meant they had a lot in common.
I mean, that was the person I felt I was competing against. If he can do it, I can do it. We were the only two people that were that age. All the other people were at least 10 years, maybe 20 or 30 years older than we were.
Springer may have entered the race a relative unknown, but he quickly began to stand out in the crowded field.
Oh, he was a star. He was just a superstar. He was way ahead of everybody else.
At the time, Cincinnati politics were dominated by entrenched elite families like the Tafts, as in William Howard Taft, the 27th president. City leaders were predominantly wealthy, white, Protestant, and Republican. Young Jerry Springer had decades of establishment inertia to overcome.
I didn't think we had a shot. I really didn't. I mean, he's a first-time runner. We busted our hump.
Snow figured that Springer could get elected eventually, but he would have to put in his time first and run a second and perhaps a third time before breaking through. But then Springer eked it out, coming in eighth out of 19 and securing one of the 9 city council seats that were up for grabs.
That was one of the greatest political victories I've ever involved with. It was great. It was terrific.
Springer's election to city council in 1971 represented a changing tide in Cincinnati. For the first time in 14 years, city council had a Democratic majority. It was the beginning of a new era. Springer's family, of course, was thrilled.
We were all very, very proud of him, but my father would say, only in America can something like this happen.
It seemed like the fulfillment of the American dream, that a refugee who moved to the U.S. seeking asylum could be elected as a leader in a major U.S. city. Springer's political staff wasted no time planning out his future. They had learned a few important things during his run. Namely, that he had a high antipathy quotient. People either loved him or hated him. Springer's campaign manager, Mike Ford, drew up a memo stating, "He is controversial. There's nothing we can do to change that." But Ford was confident. In his memo, he outlined a 10-year plan that imagined Springer leveling up from city council to Congress by 1976, and then, in 1980, moving on to the ultimate goal, the U.S. Senate.
The only thing we knew from the very beginning is he could never be president.
Tim Burke, now a long-haired Democratic Party veteran, was a legislative aide in Springer's office at City Hall, which was staffed with a tight-knit crew of young liberals. The reason Burke knew that Springer couldn't be president, of course, was that he wasn't born in the United States. But Burke was sure that Springer's political talents would take him far. He also just really believed in his ideas.
He was a great liberal. And what he did on city council in those early years documented that. At one point, he wanted to introduce an ordinance making it illegal for Cincinnatians to be drafted to go to Vietnam.
The insanity of this war must be stopped immediately. And I think we have to go to the courts. We have to do everything we can to stop it. It's been going on.
That wasn't going to go anywhere. But he started talking about that.
Springer's office quickly became a hub for young progressives in Cincinnati. Carol Sanger, a reporter for the Cincinnati Post, told us it was kind of a scene.
There was a whole group of young people who were council aides, who were just involved in city government in some way or another. And so the whole atmosphere changed at that time. It really did. And it became a very exciting, fun place to cover.
From her perch at the Cincinnati Post, Sanger reported on Springer and his cohort of civic-minded idealists. And soon she became friends with them. Sometimes they'd all go away together on weekend trips, renting a cabin in a state park.
It would be lots of serious conversations and lots of fun conversations, and also just sort of a chance to engage in visioning, you know, what you imagined could happen, could be done. You know, it was the Camelot of politics that was really very Kennedy-esque.
In keeping with that Kennedy-esque spirit, Springer pushed popular, newsworthy causes while on council that reflected his faith in government. For instance, he helped lead a campaign to take the local bus system, which was being operated badly by a private company, and make it public. The campaign succeeded, leading to better busing and lower fares. At one point, Springer got interested in the city jail, a dilapidated facility that was colloquially known as the workhouse. To capture its poor conditions, Springer secretly arranged to spend the night there.
And they have a bucket there, they have to go to the bathroom, the straw mattresses. The worst part is the idleness, I guess. They sit there all day.
Springer actually ended up spending the night in the jail's medical wing after the staff moved him there out of fear for his safety. But he stayed about 24 hours, long enough to speak vividly about what it was like.
The staff are working under horrible conditions, and they're doing the very best they can. And they're pretty progressive in their thinking. They recognize the need for more training. They recognize the need for rehabilitation programs, that you can't just build walls and have a prison. They need our help.
Tim Burke, Springer's legislative aide, said the visit really made a difference.
It didn't happen immediately, but it got more attention paid to that issue than anything had in years.
Springer had a knack for getting attention for the causes he cared about, something none of his more buttoned-up colleagues in the council had a feel for. When the city threatened to tear down the historic Art Deco train hall in Cincinnati, Springer wrote a folk song to drum up support and saved it from demolition.
And they say they're gonna tear it down with a big old wrecker's ball. Save the Union Terminal, save yourself a friend. Sell the mind's eye of
your. Oh, it's grandstanding.
Guy Guckenberger, Springer's Republican counterpart on city council, wasn't always impressed with Springer's approach to governing and making change.
It's just grandstanding, pure and simple. It's a way to get your name in the paper.
Would you consider them stunts?
Oh, sure. They were stunts. Very clever stunts.
Clever enough to win over a lot of Cincinnatians. They had never seen a politician who was so dynamic and informal and unrestrained, and they were into it.
He was refreshing, I think is the word I would use. He was just refreshing. He was able to fill a void in what had been local politics. I think that was something new in concept to City Hall.
It didn't hurt that Springer was also rather handsome.
Women liked him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was very attractive. His sense of humor, his intelligence, his position of authority, of power, whatever. You know, that whole sexual appeal was there.
Whatever it was, it worked. Just 2 years after Springer won his seat on city council in a squeaker, the 1973 election saw him come away with the second highest number of votes. Having surged in popularity between 71 and 73, Springer looked poised to become the city's next mayor. But as he built his profile locally, the allure of national politics was never far from Springer's mind.
No one can stand here and say that, you know, they haven't thought about Watergate. They haven't thought about the effect that it has on our governmental processes.
In 1973, after the Watergate scandal broke, Springer introduced an ethics ordinance in Cincinnati that would require city council members to disclose their financial investments.
And I think now more than ever before, anyone in political life has to work at trying to restore public confidence in their elected officials. And this is a way for us to say, look, we aren't doing anything wrong, and you know, we're opening up ourselves and so the public can see what kind of people we really are. No
one can stand. That same year, Springer married Mickey Velton, a graduate student whom he met on a blind date. A newspaper profile in March of 74 portrayed them as a modern, supportive couple, respectful of each other's interests and careers. Velton told the reporter, "I want him to go as far as he can. It's amazing how happy it makes him to be successful." Springer was no longer just a scrappy young upstart, but a beloved and now experienced young politician. But then,
let's talk about what happened in 74.
Nixon resigned.
Nope, not that. On April 29th, 1974, the lead story on the Cincinnati Inquirer's front page was about Watergate. Below the fold, there was an article about a different, more local bit of intrigue. The article noted that an unnamed but well-known political figure in Cincinnati was the subject of a criminal investigation into a local prostitution ring.
And it basically posed the question of which local politician was caught in a compromising situation with a prostitute in Northern Kentucky. It just raised the question. It was a tease.
Sanger's reporter instincts went off when she read the story. A source at City Hall told her that the investigation revolved around a Kentucky brothel operating as a health club just a few minutes over the border from Cincinnati. Sanger's source told her that a city councilman had visited the health club and had paid a sex worker for her services using a personal check. Sanger also learned whose signature appeared on the check.
It was Jerry Springer.
Cincinnati was about to have its own little Watergate.
I knew one side of Jerry. I didn't know the other.
That's next on Final Thoughts.
That's it for this sneak peek of Final Thoughts, Jerry Springer. If you want to hear what happened next, you can find the whole series available now on Audible. Just search for Final Thoughts, Jerry Springer on the Audible app or go to audible.com/springer. Start listening today by signing up for a free 30-day trial.